Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. And what do I want to say here? I'm Becca and I am Corinne.
We have an update. Is that what you want to say?
Yeah, we have an update. Sure. We have an update on William Henry Ireland, who Becca talked about in our last episode. He was a prolific, or maybe just infamous, notorious William Shakespeare forger from the 18th century, late 18th century.
So this update is only about, you know, I can't do math, but yeah. A long time ago. Just a little late.
Yeah. When I was looking for like a photo or something to use on the website blog post for the episode, I found a Harvard article that talked about some recent kind of findings. Like they found new pieces that he had forged. And basically what had happened was he became so popular after his forgery and like after the scam that he pulled that people like really looked at his work as a novelty item. And so he went on forging things. He basically forged forgeries. So he made more Shakespeare forgeries, but he faked them because at that point everyone knew they were already fake, in order to make more money off of them. So he just kept doing it throughout the rest of his life. And I just, I read about that and thought it was fabulous. So.
I mean, really ahead of his time, I would say.
It's like, and honestly, I can't get enough of scams right now. So we're going to go on and talk about another one in just a second. But yeah, it's kind of like all of that Fyre Festival gear that people are selling on eBay and people buying that. And it just reminds me that we've, as like a society, not changed at all.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, the only difference is we're better at getting this information from far away from us. You know what I mean? Like William Henry kind of had to be contained in the UK or in England. Yeah. But now it can be all around the world.
Yeah, exactly. The other big scandal this week was about the suspense thriller author A.J. Finn.
And a listener wrote in to us, right?
Yes.
To make sure we heard about it.
Yeah.
Which is great.
We had found out about it, but we had a listener write an email to us too. Her name is Michaela, to make sure that we had heard about A.J. Finn, whose real name is Dan Mallory. He's the author behind last year's really huge hit, The Woman in the Window, which is kind of just, in general, I'm annoyed with these types of books anyway, because they're all based off of like Gone Girl's success. So as far as I'm concerned, those are all ripoffs anyway. But this one's like extra special ripoff-y. The New Yorker article is titled A Suspense Novelist Trail of Deceptions, and it's by Ian Parker. It's quite long, but it's very thorough investigation slash list of all of this guy's griftery ways, and it's wild.
There's way too much to go into for us to like explain it. I don't know. Do you want to go over some highlights though? Some of your favorite, some choice pieces?
Yeah. Well, number one that I wanted to talk about in general is just the choice of like a very neutral, like potentially female sounding pseudonym, which is A.J. Finn, which, you know, definitely is going off of Gillian Flynn. And then also just like in general, that whole genre has got like a lot of dudes writing under pseudonyms that make them sound like they could be women, and that's very annoying to me. But then yeah, to top it off, I don't know, one of them that really gets me, I mean, like the one that everybody's talking about, is that he told everyone he had cancer, which is huge and an awful thing to do. You don't do that, obviously, it's wrong. But the one that really gets me is that he told, in order to get into college, like in his college admission essays, he wrote about how his mom was sick with cancer, and then he had a mentally challenged brother who died, and then his mom died. And like this guy that let him in, or like got him into Oxford, basically like believed all of it and thought it was all true. And that's just terrible. Yeah. I don't understand. Oh, and also when he was rejected from Princeton, he wrote the admissions office or the dean of admissions at Princeton and called him, what was it? He called him a heartless bastard and a latter-day Stalin for like for rejecting somebody who had gone through so many troubles. God. It's just insane.
Yeah. That's the part that sticks out to me, too. I don't know. I would think that his parents would be furious with him for killing them off, but I guess not. Or they don't know, or they think that everybody else is lying about him. But yeah. I also find it very interesting that he relied so heavily on his mom dying of cancer.
Uh-huh.
Just because my mom did die of cancer, and I find it really hard to even tell people that
right.
in real life. Like, I feel like, because I instantly know it's going to make the other person uncomfortable, and I don't want to do that. So I try to just, like, avoid it and hope they guess. Hope they figure out what happened somehow.
Or, like, I mean, like, you don't just necessarily bring it up because, like, what's to gain from it? It's a thing that people right. know as they get to know you, or, like, as you become more intimate, like, as friends go and, like, your conversations become more intimate. It's not something you lead with, like, in order to get something. And that's really where, I mean, obviously it's gross for that reason. I don't know. Do you have a favorite part? Or, oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. And I think the ending is maybe the best part, because in the end, Dan Mallory does admit that he made up everything of him having cancer. But he used the excuse basically of, oh, I didn't realize what I was doing. I don't remember
anything. Because he has a bipolar diagnosis, which the article does, like, to the article's credit, definitely says, like, none of these are really symptoms of bipolar 2 disorder. He, like, checked with, like, multiple psychologists and stuff, and they're like, no, this is really not, like, in order to not malign people who have this disorder, like, these are not symptoms of people who have bipolar 2. And then he goes on to use that as an excuse for what he did too. And it just goes to show, I think, how I keep my thoughts organized, because I just keep remembering stuff. But it really goes to show how much, like, a white guy can get away with if he's just, like, confident enough.
Oh, that was one thing. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Oh my goodness. I gotta look up the exact quote now. But that's one thing that really stuck out to me, because I'm like, how are these people not checking whether he graduated from college?
Right.
Like, I have had to do background checks. I've had to, like, had companies, like, pay several hundred dollars to do a background check on me in Australia, because I lived in Australia.
Right.
And these are not for, like, important jobs. Like, I'm not gonna say how much I made at these jobs, but it was not very much.
Right.
So it's just crazy to me that, like, I go through all of that, and then this guy is just like, oh, you say that you graduated? Cool. That's all we need.
It's like I was saying, like, I'm terrified. Like, every once in a while, I'll look to see if there's job opportunities out there for me. And I will look and I'll read the requirements, basically. And it'll say so much experience with this thing. And I'll be like, I mean, I kind of have experience, but if I put that on a resume, will they find out that I don't really have experience? And then what's going to happen to me? And this guy got away with this for so long. He got, like, a $10 million three-book deal or something like that. It's nuts. And he had a career that spanned, like, a decade, having told people that he had a double doctorate, one of them from Oxford, and he didn't. I mean, he did go to Oxford, but he never got his degree.
It blows my mind. And it's like, I can't find the paragraph now, but...
So one of Mallory's London colleagues, to whom I spoke at length, described publishing as, quote, a soft industry, and much more so in London than in New York, end quote. Hiring standards in London have improved in the past decade, this colleague said, but at the time of Mallory's hiring, quote, it was much more a case of, I like the cut of your jib, you can have a job, rather than, have you actually got a PhD from Oxford, and were you an editor at Ballantine? End quote. Because he said he was an editor at Ballantine, but he was really just an assistant.
Yeah, this is the thing that really bothers me, because people want to say, oh, just diversity hires and affirmative action, like, that stuff's not right. But what I don't think they understand, or they're willfully not understanding it, is for a long time, the people in power have been white men. So they're the people who are doing the hiring. And if they're not checking backgrounds, did you really go to Oxford? They're just relying on I like this guy. So who are the people who they're generally going to like? Other right. white guys.
Yeah. It's maddening in that respect, for sure. And then that kind of rage is tempered with just the sheer off-the-wall bonkersness of everything he
yes.
pulled off and got away with. I do want to know what the fallout from this is going to be. Because he's got, like, another book planned that's, like, also basically based on what's happening right now. And I cannot stand it. Because the woman in the window is basically everything that he's pulled for the last 10 years or whatever. So it's
also could be plagiarized from another movie.
Yeah,
it's possible.
Of course.
Oh, but the movie for it has already been filmed. The movie
yeah,
for
it's got
a
Amy
woman
Adams
in, the window.
In it.
Yeah,
which ship says because I love Amy Adams.
I know. I was gonna say I do kind of love the story though because I automatically don't trust male novelists who do this thing with their names, like
yes.
Riley Sager. I read a book of his that was really terrible and reviewed it. You can check out my Goodreads. And so it just kind of confirms to me, like, yes, you are right for not trusting these people.
Right. It's all just kind of like this blatant cash grab, but it's just really, I mean, there's so many people out there legitimately trying to get books published that I can't believe this is the kind of thing that sets off like a bidding war for a book deal.
Yeah.
Especially because everybody knew him, like in New York, the way that the article makes it sound. Like everyone had yeah. worked with him or heard about him and knew he was a liar or got really weird feelings from him. But because the publisher says that, like, they don't care about their employees' personal lives, which is just like, sure, that they didn't care because he was bringing in enough money to the company.
Ugh,
I just,
man,
I guess it pays to be a real jackass, but whatever. I'll just go on with my crippling anxiety about whether or not I have enough search engine optimization experience.
What, am I proficient at Microsoft Excel or am I just like average at Microsoft Excel?
And if I oversell myself on it, are they gonna like call my whole family and tell me I'm a failure?
Yes.
Oh my god.
Man, that's fun. Scams are fun.
Scams are fun. It's been a real year and a half of them, and I
a real
just...
banner month and a half for.
We're discussing Howl's Moving Castle by Diana Wynne Jones because we read it. You got a summary for us.
Yeah, I do. So Sophie Hatter is our main character. She has two sisters, Letty and Martha, who are beautiful and great. I guess I should have put this in there, but there's something about Sophie being the oldest, which means she is destined to fail at life.
Yep.
I don't know, but it's repeated over and over again.
It is presented as a fact that the oldest of three daughters will be a failure.
So that means that Sophie doesn't think she's beautiful or great. She is left to work the hat shop her father owned after he dies, and he leaves the shop in possession of her stepmother, Fanny. It is Fanny, right?
Yep.
Oh, it's not a good name.
Take a load off, Fanny.
So Letty and Martha are sent away to be apprentices. Sophie proves to be quite the virtuoso at making hats, and soon enough the hat shop is making money hand over fist. One day, the Witch of the Waste flies in and curses Sophie to be an old woman. Sophie is like, I gotta get out of here, Fanny will never recognize me. So she leaves and stumbles around until she finds Howl's Moving Castle and essentially grabs onto the castle and forces her way in. Once she's inside, she meets Michael, Howl's apprentice, and Calcifer, a fire demon living in the fireplace. Soon, Sophie also meets Howl, who appears to be annoyed at her constantly. Sophie becomes troubled by Howl's wooing of various women, including one of her sisters, and confused by the world where Howl came from, a faraway place called Wales. Eventually, Sophie discovers she is capable of magic. She has many adventures in the moving castle with Howl, Michael, and Calcifer, but it all turns out okay in the end. And I guess I didn't realize this, but her stepmother's name is Fanny, and this is actually kind of set in the UK, right?
Yeah. I think, well, Jones is British.
Is she?
Yeah. British novelist, poet, academic, short story writer. Well, she was. Because she passed away in 2011.
I just thought Fanny was a name.
The other side of the thing that we think Fanny is.
Yes. So I guess I'm just surprised that Jones would have that as a name, but maybe it wasn't when this was written, it wasn't a name back then. But
well, isn't
anyways.
That why like Fanny Hill the novel is like scandalous?
Oh, I don't know.
I think Fanny Hill.
That's a good question.
Now we're really going down a.
Maybe it's because
yeah, memoirs
we're not...
of a woman of pleasure, Fanny Hill. Yeah. It's an erotic novel. Anyway.
We should read a really old erotic novel, like a real erotic novel for this podcast.
We probably should.
Anyways.
Let's get this podcast back on track here. So, yeah. I think this episode's going to be like a real unpopular opinion, because I know a lot of people love this book. I know a lot of people love the story from the studio. Is it Ghibli?
I'm not sure.
I think. Movie adaptation of it. This is both of our first times like either reading it, and neither of us have seen the movie at this point either. So we're coming into this fresh at over 30 years old as humans. So we are going to have slightly different opinions on it than I think the popular opinion happens to be. So let's see how this goes.
I guess the first thing I'll start with is something overall, and that is this book is quite upbeat and lighthearted.
Yeah.
I personally do not like lighthearted fantasy. I think that's why I much prefer the later Harry Potter books than the earlier ones.
Yeah.
But I also think that there was always a real threat of death in the Harry Potter books. So I do think it was not nearly, even in its most like lighthearted moments, it wasn't nearly as much as this book.
Yeah. This doesn't feel like the stakes are very high at any point.
Yeah, it just, I never
doesn't
really
feel like there's much at risk.
Yeah, I never really felt like there was any danger. They were scared of the Witch of the Waste, who had it out for Howl.
But you don't know what the risk is. Like, you don't,
right.
There's no indication really of what she'll do. You just know, you just hear that she's awful. Which, like, even Howl, it feels like, had more of a, like, a scary story around him, that he ate young women.
Yeah.
That, at least, there's, like, something to be terrified of, like, sort of concrete, even if it wasn't true. So I wanted to ask you, sort of related to this, what age group do you think this book is aimed at? Like, what if you had to say, this isn't, like, a trivia kind of situation.
No. See, I assumed it was more YA when I picked it up, knowing nothing about it, really.
Right.
But then as I read it, I feel like, the writing's pretty simple. It almost feels more like middle school, you know, maybe like 11 or 12. But the thing is essentially the entire plot is basically just to make Sophie and Howl, I guess, fall in love forever and be together forever is what it's implied.
Right. And they're adults.
And that feels like
that's the confusing part for me.
Right. That feels like that's not something that maybe an 11-year-old is going to be interested in reading.
Right. I just couldn't quite nail down like who it was for, because it does read like a fairy tale. So there's that. Yeah. And it reads like a fairy tale that's like being told to you by someone like actually speaking to you. It doesn't feel like a book. It feels like something that's supposed to be read or like read aloud, which it also makes me think of it being for younger kids. But then again, like you said, it's essentially about adults. Sophie's a young adult at least, but like, you know, everybody else is in their 20s pretty much. I don't know. It's a weird kind of thing. I find it interesting, I guess, that kids would be into it for that reason. I don't know that that kind of romance story is something that most kids are like into. I don't know.
I know. This book kind of makes me, I have a hard time gathering my thoughts around it, but it's also strange because it's, the main character is a girl, and that's really great, but she doesn't really do much. So I don't even really feel like it has the idea of like, oh, look, here's a fantasy adventure story with a girl as the main character that's going to appeal to girls who are into fantasy who aren't finding what they want in like male-led fantasies. And
right.
I mean, she does do some stuff, mostly towards the end, I don't know. It just doesn't, it didn't speak to me, I guess. And me? So I guess I would be interested if somebody read it when they were like, you know, 12, 13 years old. What was it about it that made right. you really love it? Because I can also understand if you read it when you were young and you still love it, that makes total sense. I'm sure there's plenty of books that I still would love today that probably aren't that good, but it's because I have the good feelings about it from when I was yeah. a kid.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that probably accounts for a lot of it, people's feelings about it and everything. And it could also account for me, like the state of mind I've been in while I've been reading it. Like, you know, that could account for the way that I feel about it too. But yeah, I felt like the character development of Sophie particularly was like very, I don't know, maybe the development of the whole novel was very kind of one note up until like the last little chunk of it, like where the climax hits, and then everything mm-hmm. happens so fast that I can't even really explain what happened at all. So
that's I don't think we even probably need to go into it, because it just was a lot of plot in the end. It's sort of like a like somebody explaining, hey, this is everything that happened.
Right.
And now this is all the stuff that's going to happen because of it. But what it really led to was Sophie finding out that Howell knew she had a spell on her the entire time.
Not even just Howell, but like everybody.
Everybody did. Knew. And yeah. nobody said anything. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I do feel bad for criticizing it, but you can't leave. This is a gigantic plot hole.
I know.
Nobody once said to Sophie, like, hey, do you have a spell on you? Like, Howell would know. Howell should know if he's this great wizard.
He did know, and he says that he did know.
But I mean, he should know that she can't say anything about the spell.
Yeah.
So he should give her the opening, like Calcifer did.
Right. Yeah.
So why didn't he?
I don't know. I don't know. And I just, I think maybe there is like something to be said, like the book is trying to do this thing about how, like, because I think Howell mentions that he got to the point where he thought that she was just keeping the spell on herself because she liked it that way or whatever. And I think there is something to be said about this idea that maybe Sophie's self-esteem was so low that that's how she thought of herself, as just this little old woman who couldn't accomplish anything, even though she was continuously accomplishing things throughout the novel. And it took until, you know, the very last big action sequence for her to realize that she was capable of it, and then she could become young and beautiful and able again. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that's the message you're getting. But yeah, that is like what you said. It's a plot hole, though, to also have everybody know about it and not tell her, because that was like the whole point of her going to Howl's Castle in the first place, is to get help to get the spell off of her.
And I think that is a cool idea, and I do like that she learns that she's very capable, even when she's an old woman and could have mm-hmm. a heart attack at any second. She can do all this stuff. But when we see her realize that at the end, it's also mixed up with these feelings of jealousy that yes. Howell is in love with somebody else. So it kind of like just taints the whole thing for me, because it does. And I mean, I can chalk this up to this being an older book, but it does really it's kind of like, oh yeah, girls are jealous. That's what do. We are just jealous.
It does that throughout, you know, like all of these girls' only purpose or like only thing they really bring to anything, even though they also have, you know, skill and whatever, is just that they're beautiful. And I think that also rubbed me the wrong way. And there are a lot of like outdated gender role things in this. I know your favorite thing is that Sophie basically is a maid, and that's her only role is being a maid, cleaning up after these guys, like all these guys in a castle, and then also sewing clothes for them. It's just that.
That's and she enjoys it. Like, she immediately wants to. And even in the end, there's Sophie and two other people. I can't remember. Two older women. And they finally get into Howell's bedroom, which he's been keeping locked. And immediately the two older women are like, we got to clean this.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and I guess that's partly just my thing. For me personally, I would rather have no women at all than have to read stereotypical women.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true for everybody. And I think that's totally fair if you would at least rather have women in the story. And I get that. It's just not for me.
I also, yeah, that's weird. And it's also weird to me. I think you have this outlined too, but the magic of this world is not explained, which is, I mean, not saying that like it needs to be huge and complicated, but it's not explained to the point that like anything is possible, which means that nothing matters, basically. Like,
yeah,
because Sophie is apparently magical and she can do magic just by talking to things. But then her sister is like an apprentice to a witch, and Howl is obviously a powerful wizard and he has an apprentice. So like people could be learning, like she could be learning from Howl. I just don't understand exactly like what the point of all of that was. It seemed like a weird system to set up. To make it mean almost nothing.
That's the thing, is it's also sort of, I don't know, it's kind of outright stated that really the only thing that matters is your intentions. Because when people keep knocking at the door, when I think Sophie has to answer it because Michael and Howl are gone, and she has to put together these packets of powders for spells for these people. It's, I think Calcifer says to her like, oh, it really doesn't matter that much.
Yeah.
Like what you are putting in these spells. It just matters like that you say it confidently to these people. And I don't know if it meant like, I mean, I don't know if that meant like, oh, just like, you know, selling them nothing.
Yeah. Like a confidence man. Yeah.
Right. But talk about scams. But, but what I took it as is that's the part of magic that matters. The actual contents of the spell doesn't matter. Don't matter. So why was Michael like stressing out about getting spells perfect when it doesn't really matter? Which is it, I guess? You can't have both.
I don't know. It reminds me of Children of Blood and Bone in that respect. It's like some people just knew how to use magic and some people could do it just like from their body, but the main character needed incantations in order to do it. It was very mixed up in its logic.
Well, and it really, this is a weird tangent, but it really makes me think of how so many fantasy stories start out in like schools or with the main character learning how to do what they need to do, because how else do you show it properly? Because this doesn't really work for me to know Sophie all of a sudden being like, oh, that's why we sold so many hats, because I talked to the hats as I made them. That's why the Witch of the Waste was mad at me.
Everyone thinks Howl's so sexy, because I talked to the suit about how nice the suit is.
Also, like, I had a hard time picturing the suits he was wearing.
I know.
So I pretty much just pictured him in, like, a zoot suit every time.
I was thinking, like, a jester's outfit. Yes. with big bell sleeves.
Because they talk about the sleeves, yes. And, like, big bell bottoms. And everything's made out of, like, the stuff that, like, parachutes are made out of.
Yeah, like, it's like velvet patchwork.
I was just like, how did they ever think this guy was scary?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is they say that he eats women and like, they make it sound like he's so terrible and scary and eats women, but all of the women are, like, happy to fall in love with him all of the time. So it's not like anybody's running from him. I don't quite understand that either. But, like, not to dump on the book a whole lot, there are some things that I thought were nice that I liked. Some of the things that happened or some of the elements of the world I thought were pretty cool and clever. The moving castle, for one, I thought was neat. I liked that it kind of existed in, or like outside of dimension. So they had like a door that they could turn the doorknob in certain ways and then open the door and it would like lead out into different parts of the world. And I thought that was really cool and like a neat idea because it meant that like if Sophie was in the house working on something and somebody knocked on the door, she didn't know like where they were. They could be like in this city area where the palace is, or it could have been in her hometown, or it could have been in this seaside town, or, you know, from Wales, the far distant mysterious place that is the real world Wales. And that was cool.
I did think Calcifer was my favorite character.
Yeah.
I thought he was pretty funny and just a good character in general.
Yeah.
I also really liked The Moving Castle. I'm actually, weirdly, for how much I didn't really enjoy this book, I'm looking forward to watching the movie.
Yeah.
Because I think that's where this book will, like, shines, is the visuals. The scarecrow with the turnip for his head. I mean, so I do have a little bit of mixed feelings. Because on one hand, I think it could be, like, terrifying, because scarecrows can be terrifying.
Right.
But because the book had no stakes, I never felt anyone was ever in danger.
Yeah.
It just kind of came off as, like, comical, because she kept referring to, like, his turnip head.
Right.
But I still liked it. I still really liked the idea of that visual.
And also that first encounter that she had with the scarecrow is just, like, a sweet moment.
Yes.
Where she, you know, runs into this thing that's trapped in a bush and she puts it upright and says, you know, like, there you go, friend, or whatever, some similar kind of sentiment, and then moves on. I didn't really understand her fear of it. I mean, I guess just because it was moving and scarecrow shouldn't move, but it never felt scary to me either. But yeah, I thought it was a funny element.
I did like how when Sophie first became an old woman, she was like, she kind of bullied her way into Howl's Castle and talking to Michael, and she's like, nope, I'm staying here, kind of thing. And she's like, oh, I'm old, I no longer have to care, like, something in my brain has changed that I no longer have to care about what I say or what people think of me. And I really liked that, although it does contradict how her character development is supposed to be, because she switched so quick instantly when she became an old woman. Her, like, personality changed.
Yeah.
Which isn't consistent with her having to slowly realize and get up her confidence. But
yeah.
I still really, really liked that.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny.
Yeah. I thought, I mean, it was a sweet book, and I did listen to parts of it. I found an audiobook available on YouTube. It's probably illegally licensed, so don't tell anyone I told you about it. But it's read really well, and the, like, characterizations are very, very lively. And I think that's what I was missing when I was reading this, just, like, on the page. So I found that really charming. I was still confused by parts of it. Especially in, like, the latter part of the book when the dog man shows up. I can't quite remember or figure out where he came from or why he came from anything. Even though, I mean, I do know some specifics about him. But his whole contrivance just feels very, contrived. How's that work for that sentence? And it just, it doesn't work for me exactly. And every time anything was happening, I was like, why is this happening? And it didn't feel like it resolved very well. That being said, the audiobook I liked better than actually reading it. So I think that's how this might have worked better for me and why I think, like, a movie would also be a good option.
Yeah. And I think especially with how we did mention the writing is fairly simple. You definitely, I think it would benefit from somebody, I don't know, hearing a tone, like having it emphasized in the right way, having it acted.
Yes, absolutely.
Just one more complaint.
Sure.
Howl is, like, thousands of years old, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
And Sophie is 16 or 18?
Yeah, she's... Yes, like in her late teens.
So Howl is, like, thousands of years older than her. And so regardless of how old she is, it creeps me out. And I don't understand why writers, fantasy writers specifically, keep doing this.
Yeah.
And he has gone out and fallen in love with tons of women. But then Sophie has never loved anybody other than him.
Yeah.
And I just do not like that trope.
Okay, I am gonna try to fact check you on how old he is. The fandom wiki for it says he's 27 to 30, and I know that she says, like, he's in his 20s or something in the book when she first meets him, and I'm not saying that he's not also thousands of years old, because I don't understand the timeline of this book.
Be wrong. No, you might have to take out all of that, because I might have just read it incorrectly. Because it says in Wikipedia, he is 27. He states that he will soon be 10,000 days old, which is part of the witch's curse.
10,000 days old.
So okay. I probably read that as 10,000 years old. So just make a little note of that.
That's fine. Well, what I will say about it is, like, because of the writing, and I think because of what we talked about earlier in this episode, is that I had a hard time thinking of Sophie as a woman. Like, I kept thinking of her as a little girl who just got turned into 90 years old, just because everything felt so, I don't, like, childish, and everything that happened was very cartoony. And I know, like, part of that's because it's written for children, but it was very difficult to keep in mind how old everybody was. And it's also hard to think of, like, a wizard as a young man instead of, like, 1,000 years old, because how old is the Witch of the Waste? And I don't know. Like, a lot of it was difficult to kind of, like, get a real grasp on those sorts of things because of the tone, I think.
Yeah. And it, you know, it did say that he has, all he does is go around and make women fall in love with him and then just ghosts them, which is really terrible behavior.
Yeah.
Why would Sophie want to be with somebody like that? And of course, it's the old trope of, like, oh, but you're different than all the other girls. And
she's the one who's going to put an end to that.
I don't like that. And I especially don't like it in a book for young readers.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And yeah, well, the other thing about it is, you know, like, an argument against this being, like, a really strong female character is that all of the action sequences she's just watching happen or, like, running along behind it. None of the action sequences really feel all that exciting because, like, one of them, they're watching it from shore and it's happening, like, way out at sea. And then, you know, later on, she's just watching it happen again. And so, yeah, it doesn't really feel like strong female character. It just feels like girl finding her way and then getting the magical man to fall in love with her, which isn't terribly satisfying. Also, they didn't have any chemistry, so there's that.
Not even close. And I mean, which makes sense because she's an old woman and he's like 27 years old or whatever. Yeah. But, like, I don't understand at no point at all. Because, I mean, I knew they were going to fall in love because, of course, they are. Like, it's easily, you know, you could see it a mile away. But I was like, well, maybe they're not because there's nothing here between them.
Not that I expect a book for, you know, 12-year-olds to be filled with sexual tension, but...
No. But I guess that's the strange part.
He and Letty probably had more in common since she was studying, you know, magic with somebody that he knew.
Also, which one was Michael in love with? Martha or Letty?
He was in love with Martha.
Okay. But he thought he was in love with Letty because she looked like Letty.
Right. And she was still going by Letty. Yeah.
That was confusing. And I'm not really sure what the point of that was either.
No, neither am I.
I guess that is what it is. It was just a bunch of things thrown in that didn't really make any sense just to cause an obstacle for Sophie.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have made a difference, really.
Yeah.
Letty could have just been to the witch to be her apprentice from the beginning. But the book sets up Fanny, the stepmother, to be this, you know, like, mean money grubbing person at first, and then at the very end she's magically very nice and wasn't that at all, even though she did send Martha to the to originally be the witch's apprentice because she wanted Martha. She sent Martha even though Letty was really more suited for it, and it doesn't make sense. I don't really, it's the way that it all kind of unfolds is to be like, look at what we thought was bad about all of these people, but really, nope, they're all nice. Everybody had it wrong. It doesn't make a lot of sense and doesn't tie up right.
Yeah, and that's why I think we're just confused about who this is for, because that does feel like a pretty young age of people who would enjoy that, and that's good.
I don't know. I mean, I've also read a lot of other books for young people that I think come together a little bit more neatly. And I don't mean neatly in, like, presented nicely, but fill in a lot of gaps better than this.
Well, Well, thanks for listening.
If you want to call us and yell at us because you love Howl's Moving Castle, which you should. You should love it and love it to death. Go ahead and give us a call at 616-730-1656. We might play it on an episode, or you can email us at thebookstorepodcast@gmail.com.
Our next book discussion will be My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday. Bye.
Bye.
I'm talking to my mic like it's a person named Mike.